Phonic FM on 106.8 FM, Exeter Sound Alternative.
You're listening to A Day, and this show is called Ahead of the Curve. And today we're going to be talking about Kropotkin, and some of your keen listeners will know that we discussed some Kropotkin a few weeks ago with some people from the Engaging with Radical Ideas group. We've got with us on the phone, got Roman Krasnarek, who's a writer and teacher on creative thinking about the art of living and social change. And he's a co-founder of the School of Life, a social enterprise in London that offers instruction and inspiration on how to live wisely and well. Much of his work centres on empathy, and he advises on organisations, including Oxfam and the United Nations, on using empathy and conversation to create social change. Roman's previously taught sociology and politics at Cambridge University and City University of London, and has done human rights works in Central America with refugees and indigenous people. He's been a project director at the Oxford Muse, the Avant-Garde Foundation to stimulate courage and invention in personal, professional and cultural life, and he writes a blog dedicated to empathy called Outrospection. That's outrospection.org, and I think you'd be welcome to go and have a look at that while he's on the show, and perhaps even email in with some questions at studio@phonic.fm. Perhaps we'll talk about a book, the latest book, a little later on, which is on what history can teach us about the art of living. That's came out in January, I think. So we've got Roman on the phone with us. Roman, can you hear us? Are you?
Yeah, I can hear absolutely fine.
Excellent, and he's coming through well here too, which is great. So we're revisiting, in a way, the Kropotkin's work, in particular mutual aid. But in today's context, we're able to look at how some of Kropotkin's ideas have filtered through into some of the kind of practices and projects that people carry out today, which I think is the sorts of things that you do, Roman. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think Kropotkin's one of the great sort of prophets of the past who's relevant for today, and he's absolutely shaped the work that I do around empathy and the way that empathy can be force for, you know, radical social change. And a lot of my own work has, you know, drawn on Kropotkin's writing in Mutual Aid and also some of his other books.
Yeah, so and that's very interesting. And we hope to talk about a bit more about that in a few moments. Maybe we can talk about the empathy. But can you help listeners to remind them of what we talked about Kropotkin last time? There's a bit of a recap on his biography, if possible.
Yeah, Kropotkin was one of the great revolutionary thinkers of the 19th century, as important as Tolstoy and not as well known as Marx, but he had a huge social impact. Like Tolstoy, he came from an aristocratic Russian family. He was born in the early 1840s. And like Tolstoy, he went down another path, and he turned away from his privileged background. You know, his family owned over 1,000 serfs. He was brought up to be an attendant of the Tsar and was a member of the Corps of Pages, which was, he kind of went to a military training academy to be an attendant at court. But after having spent some time in the army, he then went in another direction. In fact, he went in two directions. One direction is he became a scientist, a great natural scientist and an expert on mountain ranges, and he wrote hundreds of scientific papers as a geographer. But he also became a revolutionary propagandist and anarchist. And the great turning point in his life was in the early 1870s, in 1872, where he went to Switzerland and spent time with watchmakers in the Jura Mountains who were anarchists, who believed that society should be organized, not dominated by the state, not dominated by big business and capitalism, but workers organizing themselves, that the economy should be organized through worker cooperatives. And he saw that in action, and that absolutely converted him towards an anarchist way of thinking and away from a socialist or a Marxist idea that, you know, we ought to rely on the big state to sort out all our problems and create equality. And after that conversion in 1872, he then dedicated himself to spreading anarchist ideas. He was thrown in jail in 1874, and a couple of years later, he made a miraculous escape, jumping on the back of a carriage. And for the rest of his life, until 1921, he spread anarchist ideas and was a writer, effectively, most of the time, in France, in Britain, and other countries as well.
And then he wrote Mutual Aid in that latter part. And I was wondering if you can maybe look at how Mutual Aid becomes kind of a focal point of some of these ideas that he was fermenting in the early part of his life, and through that period of transitioning into dealing with ideas of anarchism.
Yeah, Mutual Aid was, you know, published just after 1900 and 1902, but he'd been working on those ideas for many, many years beforehand. And as a book, I think it's absolutely relevant today and is something that should be, you know, read today even by students of sociology or politics, evolutionary biology, primary school kids as well, I think. And what's interesting about the book is that it's divided into two parts, which draw on different parts of his thinking. The first part really draws on his scientific ideas. As you know, he looks at the way that there is an enormous amount of social cooperation in the animal world and the insect world. He looks at pelicans and he looks at chimpanzees and bees, and shows how this, just as we have this common idea, a Darwinian idea, that there's, you know, that evolution happens through conflict, he emphasized the social cooperation, the way that species will share food, they will protect each other from predators with calls out so they can, you know, all run away from the tiger or whatever it happens to be. And he saw that that was an absolutely natural part of the sort of planetary systems and the biological world. But he saw that that kind of mutual aid amongst animals also existed in humans. And the second part of his book traces the way that humans have cooperated since the medieval period, particularly in Europe, right up until when he was writing in the late 19th century. And he looked at the rise of the medieval guild system, the rise of voluntary organizations, cooperatives, allotments. He saw anarchism existing in everyday life. He saw it all around him. He didn't think anarchism was a utopian ideal of a future state. He saw it in social cooperation and local organizations based on non-hierarchical associationalism, right there in front of him.
I think that's quite an important point as well, isn't it? This is not necessarily about utopian thinking. It's about realizing what's actually existing at the time. In his experiences, and perhaps this might help us also to connect with some of these ways of organising ourselves actually occurring nowadays too.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think in the public there's a common misconception of anarchism, or a very one-sided view of it. It's generally seen in the public eyes, you know, anarchists are in the 19th century were the guys who tried to blow up tsars and overthrow states. Today, anarchists are associated with, you know, masked, you know, rioters in anti-capitalist demonstrations and so on. But there's a whole other tradition of anarchist thinking, which Kropotkin embodied, and his great 20th century disciple, the British anarchist Colin Ward, also embodied, which was the idea of anarchy as a form of social organization. That, just as you say, anarchism was not utopian from that perspective. And I think Kropotkin was not really utopian at all. He was very much a realist. So, for example, in his book Mutual Aid, he looks at an organization which still exists today, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution. He said that was a perfect example of an anarchist organization. It was founded in 1824. It was highly decentralized, as it still is today. There's no strong central organization. It involved local volunteers doing something extraordinarily important, which was saving strangers whose ships had been wrecked and who were caught in storms. And Kropotkin pointed out how, isn't it extraordinary how people, you know, villagers who man local lifeboats will go out and help strangers. This is not about the self-interest of a Hobbesian world where there's a war of all against all. This is a kind of empathic response based on mutual aid and mutual cooperation, where we'll go and help others. And Kropotkin saw examples like the Lifeboat Association, now the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, as proof that mutual aid and anarchist organization could actually do really useful tasks in society that the state didn't need to do and couldn't even do as effectively, and capitalism couldn't do as effectively either, but local communities could do it, powered from the grassroots by a kind of a philosophy of mutual aid. So he would very much look at a lot of organizations around today, from transition towns to allotments to car sharing associations, and say that is anarchy in action.
And a very important point about anarchy is, as you mentioned, is this sort of what's been called on this show before, a horizontal structure, horizontal accountability. So there isn't this sense of hierarchy of accountability that you have with a lot of state organisations and in capitalist organisations. So that's a difference. But also, I think the point that you've raised very clearly is a lot of the examples that we're very well aware of, like the Lifeboat Association, just viewed slightly differently through a different framework, and this framework of empathy and understanding this concept of people coming together or doing things for each other that's actually going to be a benefit for them. How does that then work with some of your own work? If you could maybe take a few moments to look at that.
Yeah, I mean, Kropotkin raises a question, really, which is, well, if mutual aid is such a great thing, if it's such an important historical form of organization, the way that human beings naturally do form cooperatives and voluntary associations, which, as you say, sort of a horizontal and non-hierarchical. The question that raises for me is, well, how do you promote that mutual aid? Because Kropotkin really saw it as a fundamental form of social change. What we needed to do was to expand those kinds of associations, like cooperatives, like allotments, even the way children play together in the playground, in sort of cooperative games. How do you do that in everyday society? And in terms of my sort of personal story, I used to be a political scientist, and I used to believe that the best way to change society was through changing laws and state institutions and promoting human rights, but sort of a traditional kind of reformist left politics. And gradually, I realized that that was not enough, that, in fact, the most radical changes in history, as I saw them, came through mutual aid, came through, in a way, a revolution of human relationships, through people learning to step into each other's shoes and see the world differently and come to care about other human beings whose lives were very different from their own. And that is about empathy. There's a famous German anarchist called Gustav Landauer who said something very interesting. He said, "The state is not something which can be destroyed by a revolution, but is a condition, a certain relationship between human beings, a mode of human behavior. We destroy it by contracting other relationships, by behaving differently." And that idea was very much in the Kropotkin vein and made me think that we need to learn how to contract different relationships in society. And that brought me to an interest in empathy. And just to define briefly what empathy really is, if you pick up a psychology textbook, there are two definitions of empathy that you'll see. The first kind is what's called affective empathy. So if you see a child who's crying in anguish and you too feel anguish, that's called affective empathy. It's about sharing or mirroring somebody's emotions. But there's another kind of empathy which is called cognitive empathy or perspective taking empathy, and that's an empathy about stepping into the shoes of another person and seeing the world through their eyes. That's about when you see someone who's homeless outside your local Tesco's, you try and step into their shoes and not pity them or feel sorry for them, but try and understand, well, what was it like to sleep out overnight last night in the freezing cold? What's it like to be ignored by people who walk past you in the street every day? And I believe that empathy of that kind, learning to step into other people's shoes, is a force for creating mutual aid, for in Kropotkin's sort of way of thinking, a force for radical social change and creating human bonds that we desperately need to create in the 21st century.
Yeah, and this type of empathy that you mentioned, you talked the first type of empathy is something that is very well documented, as well as the cognitive one. I've seen quite a few people that have mentioned this in some of the work recently, but the kind of work that you do now then to encourage people into this process of engaging with others, this cognitive empathy, how does that work? How do you kind of get people involved with understanding how other people live?
Well, I think one of the things to do is to nurture the art of conversation, which doesn't sound very political, does it, when you first think about it? I used to work for an organization called the Oxford Muse, M-U-S-E, which was invented to try and create conversations between strangers, to try and get CEOs of oil companies talking to people who are living on the streets, getting poll dancers to talk to architects. And one of the things that we did was put on conversation meals, where strangers in a community would sit down and talk to each other, and instead of giving them a menu of food, we would give them a menu of conversation. And on that menu would be questions like, what have you learned about the different varieties of love in the course of your life? Or in what ways have your political views changed over the years? Or how would you like to become more courageous? And the aim of these meals, which I put on, you know, all over the country and in other countries as well, was to get people to take off their masks, get beyond superficial talk, and really create human connections across social divides, people who wouldn't normally talk to each other. And out of those conversations has emerged, you know, various social projects, local community projects. So partly what I've been doing is trying to promote those kinds of conversations. Really, it's about creating empathy at its most basic level, about encouraging mutual aid, you know, in local communities. You know, as simple a thing as, I live in the city of Oxford, I run a project getting Oxford University students to go to the local community centre and talk to elderly people and have conversations about their lives, to actually care about them and get them out of the cocoon of their own studies. But the other thing I've done is trying to promote the work of organizations which have a kind of empathic, radical agenda, that try to create conversations which can solve major social problems, one of which is an organization in Israel and the Palestinian territories called the Parents Circle. And if you like, I can tell you a little bit more about that.
Maybe we'd like to hear a bit more about that in a moment. Just want to sort of clarify some of the things you're saying, really. What you're talking about is kind of creating this sort of cohesiveness within society, a kind of a glue, and that glue is a human connectedness that we can all share. But in order to do that, it's very much about removing those masks, these masks that are often are created by our sense of how we might fit into the society as it exists. But this is very much more about progressing society, and so in order to do that, it's very much about removing those masks, or sort of resituating ourselves within that society, realizing it's something that can be changed, and not a fixed and stable thing, but something that's that we can have impact upon. Is that kind of a fair sort of summary of sort of part of the position that you're taking?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm an optimist about human nature. I mean, I do believe that we all have nasty sides to us. That when in the 17th century Thomas Hobbes said that, you know, in a state of nature, life is nasty, brutish, and short, and it's a war of all against all. I do partly believe that human beings left to their own devices can be incredibly horrible towards each other, both on the individual level and socially. I mean, where do wars come from? But I think Hobbes was missing the picture, and that human nature has something else in us. I mean, in the 18th century, the philosopher David Hume said, in each of us there's some particle of the dove needed into our frame, along with the elements of the wolf and the serpent. And that more cooperative side, that more nurturing and empathic side to us, which I think Kropotkin was aware of, is something that I believe we each have in us. But it's something that is not fixed. It's not just a genetic inheritance, but it's something that we can expand throughout our lives. We can learn to overcome our assumptions and prejudice against others. And I think that's a very hopeful message for social change, that we are not fixed beings. And there's 1,000 examples of extraordinary people who have, through an empathic leap into other people's imaginations and lives, changed their views. George Orwell was one of them. You know, in the 1920s, you know, he'd been brought up, he went to Eton, he was in the colonial police force in Burma. And in the late 1920s, he conducted a radical empathic experiment, which was to dress up as a tramp. And he walked along the streets of East London in the late 20s and early 30s, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for weeks at a time, dressed as a tramp, and trying to understand what it was like to live on the social margins and live in the doss houses and live in the homeless shelters. And that experience of experiential empathy absolutely changed his political views, his moral views, helped him develop new friendships. And in a way, it's a model for what all of us can do in our lives, to in a way work with that dove-like particles in us, and expand our, I guess, the good sides of us, and bring that into community organization and social change.
I think this would be maybe a nice point to mention that the Parents Circle, the project in Palestine, Israel that you're talking about. If you can mention, I mean, presumably that what you were able to find in that project are elements of the Dove in people.
Absolutely. So what the Parents Circle is, it's also sometimes known as the Bereaved Families Forum. And it's an absolutely extraordinary grassroots peace-building project in Israel and Palestinian territories. And what it does is it brings together Palestinians and Israelis who've had family members killed in the conflict. So, for example, it will bring together a Palestinian man whose son was killed by an Israeli sniper, and equally an Israeli man or woman whose daughter was blown up by a Palestinian suicide bomber. And it runs projects. And some of the projects are very basic, simply about bringing people together for conversations to make them realize that they share something, which is they shed the same blood, in a way. Because often you find these Israelis, you know, they have very prejudiced ideas of Palestinians. They've often never shaken hands with a Palestinian. But once they find someone on the other side who's suffered in the same ways they have, they create a human bond. And they've created absolutely brilliant grassroots projects together. One of the ones I love best is a blood-giving project where some of the Israeli members of the Parent Circle went to Ramallah and gave blood in a Palestinian hospital, and then the Palestinians went to Jerusalem and gave blood to the Israeli Red Cross. I mean, a literal mixing of common bloods. A more pragmatic project they had is called Hello Peace, which is an open telephone line where if you're an Israeli, you can phone a free phone number and get put through to a random Palestinian and have a conversation with them. And equally, the Palestinians can phone this number and get put through to an Israeli. And that project has logged over 1 million calls in the last few years. And the Parents Circle has become, you know, famous in Israel, though they're still very marginal because they definitely don't represent the mainstream views, but they've brought together hundreds of families and thousands, tens of thousands of people to really create what I think is necessary if you're ever going to have a solution in that part of the world to conflict, which is to get people talking across divides and realize that they're all human beings.
Mm. And perhaps not to fear disagreement as well, not to fear disagreements, not to fear the other. It's a very interesting this idea of the Parent Circle. Maybe you could explain something about the concept behind the term.
Well, the idea was initially to bring together families, to bring together parents whose children had been killed in the conflict, and to get people to understand that, you know, I'm a parent, I'm a mother with a child who's died, and you're a mother with a child who's died, and we both understand each other on some fundamental level. Of course, in everyday politics, a politician will send soldiers, you know, to war, and even though they have children themselves, they won't send their own children into that war. They don't really understand those kinds of connections. They're too distant from it. But the Parent Circle's trying to break down that distance.
Okay, well there's a nice point maybe to have a little bit of a break with some music. We're going to try and play Skip the Youth by Frightened Rabbit, and then we'll come back to speak to Roman a bit more about Kropotkin and some more of his work. We're talking today to Roman, who's been helping us understand a bit more about how Kropotkin's ideas are relevant today and how they've been used. Hopefully Roman's still on the line with us. Are you still there, Roman?
I am.
What we've talked about so far is kind of looking at the glue of society, the human glue, if you like, which kind of keeps us together, which is understanding our humanity and accessing that through conversation, breaking down the masks of prejudice that we all wear. And you've outlined some of the projects that you've been involved with, like the Parents Circle, the Muse Cafe? I can't remember.
The
Oxford Muse, which was a kind of it reminds me of something. I think there's a Pythonesque thing to this, isn't there?
A Pythonesque thing.
Was a
yeah, that's right. Well, there is in the Meaning of Life, Monty Python's Meaning of Life. There's a conversation menu offered by John Cleese, I think, when he's a waiter in one scene, because there's an American couple who don't know what to say to each other as they're sitting in a restaurant. Perhaps that's what you're thinking of.
That's right. That's what I'm thinking of. But interestingly, it's a very clear and stark example, I guess, of some of the real problems that we have when we're trying to talk to people that perhaps aren't as close to us as a husband and wife, but but across divides, nevertheless. One of the other points I've sort of picked up on reading Mutual Aid was this notion of liberation, and I wonder if we could perhaps look at that. Certainly, when you talk about some of the revolutionary aspects of people's actions in Mutual Aid, liberation seems to be a term that comes up. I wonder if there's anything you can talk about that.
I'm not sure what to really say about Kropotkin and liberation. Except that I think there are different ways to think about liberation, I mean, in relation to Kropotkin. One way is to think, okay, well, Kropotkin certainly wanted to liberate human beings from the fetters of capitalism and industrial exploitation and the fetters of the state and the control of the ideology of religion. And he was a classic anarchist in that way, and there's nothing really exceptional about that, by targeting the state, capitalism and private property and religion as something that was holding back individual freedom. I think Kropotkin's originality, really, in thinking about liberation was to posit a kind of a model of what society would look like, a kind of society which would maximize human freedom, that would liberate us to the greatest extent and maximize human well-being. And the place where he did that was not so much in his book Mutual Aid, I think, but in another book he wrote called Fields, Factories, and Workshops of Tomorrow, which was published in 1899. And that book, in a way, was a blueprint for what a future society should look like, and what it would be to be a free individual, a liberated individual, and how that would actually function. And I think it's absolutely relevant to trying to live in a resource-constrained world today, in a climate-changed world, in a world where we're challenged by soil degradation and biodiversity and a warming planet. And he had radical ideas which I think are absolutely applicable.
If you would like to, can you expand on some of those? I'm not sure if it's not something I've looked into, that book.
Right, well, that book was, in a way, his... If Mutual Aid was his sort of scientific treatise, his kind of theory of human cooperation, his book, Fields, Factories, and Workshops of Tomorrow, was his idea of what society should look like. And it contained probably three key ideas, really. One was the idea that industry is just too concentrated and too big, and it needs to be highly decentralized. And that was consistent with his ideas about the social organization should be decentralized and non-hierarchical. But key to his thinking was the second idea, was that we needed to change the way society looked like, that we live too much in huge urbanized cities, and we need to take the factories out into the fields and put the fields into the factories, that we need to combine agriculture and industry and service sector much more, in a much more small scale and integrated way. And that, you know, he had this idea of social economy. And social economy he defined as the economy of energy required to satisfy human needs. And what he was talking about was effectively low carbon living, low energy living, and what that would look like. So he was a great fan of small-scale communities which had little bits of industry, little bits of agriculture, which in many ways is what transition towns are supposed to look like, what the garden city movement, which emerged with Ebenezer Howard's ideas in the early 20th century, was supposed to look like. A third aspect of his book, Fields, Factories, and Workshops of Tomorrow, which is very relevant to how we live as individuals, was the idea that if you want to lead a good life and feel free as an individual, it's a disaster if you become a specialist, just using your talents in one specific field. He was a great advocate of being a generalist, a master of many fields. He said we need to do both brain work and manual work, to be a craftsperson, but also sit down and do mathematics or write revolutionary pamphlets. And like William Morris, also at the end of the 19th century, he thought that if we were more sort of complete people in that way, we'd be happier and feel much freer. in our lives, that we were trapped by the division of labor, which we'd inherited from the ideas of Adam Smith in the 18th century, who told us that, you know, if you wanted to increase industrial production, everyone should be doing one very small specific task. And today, you and I have been taught by our education that the best way to use your talents is to become a specialist, you know, to become a logo designer or a corporate lawyer or a philosopher specializing in the works of Derrida. But Kropotkin would say, no, we needed to be many things, which is what he did in his life. He was the geographer, the scientist, the revolutionist, and many other things besides.
And that's a healthy plurality to engage with in your own identity, as well as also it's a sort of thing that I suppose would help to increase the capacity for that human glue, because you've got more opportunities to connect and have conversations with other people and people that would otherwise be from different walks of life from yourself.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, Kropotkin, I think, was a believer in what I call being a wide achiever rather than a high achiever, being a generalist rather than a specialist. And I think if one has that wide achieving generalist attitude, one probably is more likely to be curious about other people's views and ideas, to not be so locked in one's own ideology. I mean, the classic case is, you know, economists who don't speak to anybody else except other economists and have very generally quite narrow views of human nature. And I think that can lead to a certain distancing from humanity, you know, that they have.
These ideas seem to be, certainly with regards to the intermingling of workplaces and agriculture into kind of urban living and urban living into the countryside, as it were, this kind of creating of a more sympathetic ecosystem, human ecosystem. I wonder if that has any sort of resonance with some of the scientific work that he did in mutual aid in looking at how other organisms organize themselves within the larger ecology in which they inhabited.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine, you know, he would have thought that, well, certainly that you know, animal species, you know, ants and bees and pelicans, as I mentioned, you know, that he studied, you know, were living these sort of very sort of highly cooperative kinds of existences that, you know, map onto what an ideal society, you know, should look like. But I would emphasize again, you know, that he wasn't a utopian, though he may have written this book about fields, factories, and workshops of tomorrow. He very much saw it existing today in the cooperatives that existed in England and Russia and Italy and Germany.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the ideas that relate to transition towns and was it the urban garden movement?
Yeah, and allotment gardening.
And we had a show a number of weeks ago on Rabindranath Tagore, who also had some similar ideas, actually, about the kind of the international village was the idea for that Rabindranath that we spoke about from Tagore, and this was actually a similar sort of period of time that Tagore was writing. I wonder if you're able to help us with understanding a bit more of the kind of the context of some of these ideas kind of flowing around Europe at the time.
Well, certainly in the 19th century, there was a explosion, a flowering of utopian thinking that really captured the imaginations of people from many different sort of political positions. So in the United States, and particularly in the 19th century, there was a surfeit of utopian experiments of people trying to form, live in local communities. I mean, the most famous experiment was the Welsh social reformer and founder of the cooperative movement, Robert Owen, who in the 1820s set up utopian living experiments. But he also took them out to Indiana in the United States in the late 1820s, gathering together, you know, local people to try and create small-scale industry, small textile plants, grow their own food. And most of these experiments were quite short-lived. They weren't particularly successful. But some of them, you know, did go on, and they inspired, for example, Tolstoy, who also in the 19th century had an idea of creating self-sufficient local communities. And in fact, he founded some of them, and some of his followers did. And then Gandhi was directly influenced by Tolstoy's communal experiments. He called his first ashram, founded in 1910, he called it the Tolstoy Farm, and it was formed in India. He took that idea, it was in South Africa, sorry, and then he later formed ashrams in India. And Kropotkin would have understood exactly what was going on here. He was part of this same tradition, in a way, of thinking about how to create local self-sustaining communities. But Kropotkin was a bit more of a realist, I think, than, say, Tolstoy and some of the utopian experimenters. A lot of utopian experimenters thought they could live purely off the land, whereas Kropotkin was also a modern person. You know, he believed, you know, we needed industry as well, and that could help liberate human beings and raise living standards as long as it was controlled by workers. But definitely, I think we can look back at the 19th century, that context that Kropotkin, Tolstoy, Robert Owen all came from, and see a lot of models for today. Because what was happening in the 19th century is there was a realization that the growing urban economy, with its dark satanic mills, as William Blake called them, was destroying human life, was creating alienation and poverty and urban squalor, and that this was a mistake. And I think we realize that today as well, that, you know, a city like London with 10 million people is madness. You know, there's no precedent in history for that kind of social organization being self-sustaining. And we have to look back, I think, at the 19th century in order to look forward to how we should organize our societies now.
I'm interested in the point you've raised about workers, sort of in Kropotkin's ideas, being very central to the way that things are organized. And I wonder if we could maybe dig around there a little bit more and find out a bit more about what it is about workers and that kind of self-organization that Kropotkin was fixing on as a benefit.
Yeah, so what Kropotkin believed was that in order to have a just society and an effectively functioning society, that if you allowed businesses, you know, to be highly to be very hierarchical, of course, he agreed with Marx totally on this, that the profits would be, you know, creamed off by those at the top, by the entrepreneurs, by the business owners, that it was only just for workers to own the means of production. But Kropotkin very much believed that this should happen at the local level. It was an idea that was picked up by Spanish anarchists around Barcelona in the 1930s, you know, where workers took over factories. And if you look, for example, in Britain today at the cooperative movement, you know, you might go down to your local co-op supermarket, and you have your dividend card, and you're a member of the co-op, you get some of the profits. But that wasn't what Kropotkin was talking about, because the cooperative today is a consumer cooperative where the consumers, the buyers, have some stake in it. The profits are distributed to them, but the workers don't own shares in the company or control it on a large scale. The early cooperative movement in Britain, the one where the modern co-op supermarket comes from, that early cooperative movement in the 19th century promoted the idea of worker ownership, but it was really quashed by the traditional left in the early 1820s by people like Beatrice and Sidney Webb. And that idea of worker control was, in a way, became forgotten. And I think that's something that we need to regain today and rediscover today.
I think that we do. We have some in Exeter, certainly. There's the Real Food Store, which opened recently on Paris Street. For those people that are listening in Exeter, would like to maybe go and visit it. That's an industrial providence society. It's been organised by people in the community and has been funded by people in the community that also work in the shop as well. And that's the kind of social mobilising of people and their monies and their efforts towards common good is the sort of thing that Kropotkin would have been happy to engage with, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. He would have done his shopping there for certain. you know, he would have shopped there. He would have been a supporter of the local lifeboat association. He would have owned an allotment and grown food there and shared seeds with people around him. He would have gone to a local co-op bakery to buy his bread. He would not have shopped at Tesco's. He wouldn't have bought beans which had been flown in from Kenya. He would have bought locally. And he would have totally understood the kinds of, that kind of setup that which you'd been talking around there in your local area.
Mm. And with regards to the workers owning this as well, I wonder if it's also to do with, in some way, some kind of self-regulating use. If workers and the people that are directly connected with the geographical space that the enterprise is in, and also the kind of the produce of it, are more closely connected, then it sort of self-regulates in an environmental ecological way, that it's not necessarily going to be driven for profit, but it's driven for the benefit of and for ideals that go beyond the kind of the mind of capitalists and those people that want to profiteer from the resources.
Absolutely. I mean, Kropotkin recognised that if workers control organisations or have a greater share in them, they're the real experts on the local economy and the local ecology and local resource use. So in Mutual Aid, he writes about, in Russia, about water sharing in local communities and how it was partitioned out amongst various farmers at the local level. You know, there was, you know, he wasn't a great fan of the privatized water system, and he saw that they were able to manage their water resources very effectively because they knew when the rains came, they knew how much water was available, how much was needed for their crops. And that idea was picked up very much by Kropotkin's great disciple, Colin Ward, the anarchist thinker who died last year, Britain's greatest anarchist thinker of the last century, who wrote a book called Reflected in Water about water management and how it was best if it was done locally. He actually studied Spain a lot in that book, in the region of Aragon and other areas, and saw that when local people were in control of their resources, when they owned industry and so on, they were much more ecologically responsible, and the decisions weren't being made in big cities thousands of miles away in order to satisfy shareholders and buoy up share prices.
Mm. And of course, one of the experiences that we have as through a privatised water system in this country, and we'll probably experience in the summers as a hot weather occurs, the people using water as profitably as possible. They sometimes think that because they're paying for it, they have an automatic right to use it, because that's a kind of framework within which we have a relationship with the resource. But this other idea that Kropotkin has, or that you talk about, Colin Ward, is about being far deeply connected with the availability of resource as well. What can we say then about Kropotkin's attitudes to big business, and how can large kind of corporations and institutions perhaps exist within this kind of idea of mutual framework, mutual aid, and perhaps even empathy?
Well, there was a great dream in the 1970s that it would be possible to, in a way, reform big business and make it more cooperative, with the idea of teamwork and the idea that, you know, so this happened in Volvo factories and GM factories, Ford factories, where workers were set to work in smaller teams, take greater responsibility for their work, rather than just being straight on, you know, an industrial production line, and they would switch around doing different jobs and so on. And the idea that was supposed to have more kind of worker control, more worker freedom, and that kind of thing. But I think Kropotkin would have thought that was never going to work. In fact, it never did work. Really, this kind of trying to promote a bit more autonomy and cooperation within existing large big business was a failure, because ultimately it was effectively a way to get workers to work more efficiently and squeeze more out of them and make more profits.
There's something about honesty there, then, isn't there? About the honesty of a system that's been put into place. The integrity, perhaps.
That's right. And certainly when, for example, today, if you work in a company and it sends you on a course to learn how to be more creative or more efficient with your time or something like that, of course, it's not for your benefit. It's billed as being for your benefit as an individual, to expand your creativity and make you more efficient and so on. But really, it's for, you know, the benefit of the business. That's the bottom line. And so ultimately, I think Kropotkin would say that unless we are controlling our own workplaces and have a real say in how they're run and the roles that we have, that in the end we're not going to be able to really exercise that autonomy, to feel that kind of liberation, because we'll always be at the mercy of a large corporation and the big bosses. And even though sometimes it might be okay for us, in the long term it probably won't be.
Okay, this is a nice little song. I think this is the one that you mentioned, Roman, and it's This Land Is Our Land. It's something else. It's The World Turned Upside Down by Billy Bragg. We're going to try and listen to that for a bit, and then we'll pop back. Okay, that was Billy Bragg, of course, and people will recognise that wasn't the song intended. It was, in fact, A New England by Billy Bragg, but we'll come back to play The World Turned Upside Down in a few moments' time. But just want to sort of welcome Roman back into the studio and ask him if there's any final thoughts that he'd like to share with us about Kropotkin, or perhaps mention any of the things that he's doing. There is a book that you've written as well, actually. I think that might be a good point to finish on.
Well, the book you mentioned is one I've just written, but it's not coming out until January. It's called The Lost History of How to Live, which will be published by Profile Books. But if anybody wants to follow up some of my thoughts on empathy, it's probably best to either go to my blog, www.outrospection.org, which is dedicated to empathy, and there you'll find some links to an essay I've written called Empathy and the Art of Living, which is available for free download, which in a way draws on that Kropotkin inheritance, saying that if we want to change society, we need to not so much think about changing political institutions and new laws, but through creating a revolution of human relationships, by learning to step into the shoes of other people, by crossing social divides, by really trying to overcome our prejudices. You know, if you're someone who walks past homeless people on the street every day, have that conversation. If you're somebody who thinks all management consultants are bastards, then try talking to one of them and see what happens out of that conversation and overcome your own assumptions. If you're a Muslim and think that atheists aren't worth talking to, well, maybe try and overcome that social divide and vice versa. That I think social change really happens when we come to see the world through somebody else's eyes, where we escape the limits of our own ego. And I think empathy holds the key to that. And Kropotkin would have absolutely understood that the great task of being human is to step into the shoes of another person and overcome the limits of one's own worldview.
Excellent. And of course, social change comes with changing yourself in the end, it seems. It starts with ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that individuals are the basis of what society is, that there is no such thing as the state. There is no such thing as capitalism. They're just the people who make it up. They get caught in systems. But ultimately, we have to, in a way, change ourselves. But that doesn't mean we have to be individuals. That doesn't mean that social change is about do it yourself. It's also about do it with others, that through changing yourself, through making that empathic leap into other people's shoes, that you can also create community, you create common bonds, and it's through communal action that we change society, which may well come from an individual change, but unless we act together, then we can't create the force to overcome the injustices of society.
Sure, that's very much realizing our own individual and collective power. And that's a wonderful note to finish our second session on Kropotkin and kind of related ideas. And so thank Roman very much for being involved in the discussion. We'll make some of the links that you've mentioned, Roman, available on the Phonic FM website. There's a show page called Ahead of the Curve, and we'll put that up there. And also some links hopefully will appear on the Engagement with Radical Ideas group, which is where this subject, the topic of Kropotkin, emerged from. And that's a group at the University of Exeter. People can reach that by going to blogs.exeter.ac.uk /radical ideas. Roman, thank you very much indeed for joining us and spending this hour this morning talking to us about such wonderful ideas from Kropotkin and some of the wonderful work that you're doing as well in different parts of the world and with the ideas that you're promoting with regards to empathy.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Many thanks.
Many thanks. All the best. And what we'll do now is we'll play off with that tune we were going to play before. This is The World Turned Upside Down by Billy Bragg, and I'll be back with you in a few moments' time.